What does it mean to flourish as a human? It occurs through living intentionally and thoughtfully in particular ways. Neither virtue nor its eventual fruit, happiness, comes to us accidentally. Flourishing requires that we can confidently answer the big questions in life. Why am I here? What does it mean to be human? What does Jesus on Sunday have to do with daily life during the weekday? To get the big questions right ensures we have the wisdom and resilience we need to stand against the many false narratives so pervasive in our culture today. And classical Christian education can be a vital part of that process as we form the next generation to have the wisdom that is needed to live the good life. My guest today, Dr. Jonathan Pennington, has written a new book addressing these very issues. Stay tuned for this episode of Basecamp Live.
Mountains, we all face them as we seek to influence the next generation. Get equipped to conquer the challenges, summit the peak, and shape exceptionally thoughtful, compassionate, and flourishing human beings. We call it Ancient Future Education for Raising the Next Generation. Welcome to Basecamp Live. Now your host, Davies Owens.
Welcome to Basecamp Live. Davies Owens on the line with Jonathan Pennington. How are you, Jonathan?
Hey, I'm doing great. Glad to be here.
It's so good to have you. You're the Associate Pastor of New Testament Interpretation at Southern Seminary there in Louisville. You have quite a, you're a busy guy, visiting professor at Reformed Theological Seminary, and you preach and teach all around the country. You're now just recently jumped in as a spiritual formation pastor at your church. So, and how often do you preach? Sounds like you're doing that a good bit.
Yeah, I preach about a third of the time or so.
Wonderful. Well, that is outstanding. You've got a BA in history and teaching certificate from Northern Illinois University and an MDiv from Trinity Evangelical Divinity School there in Chicago. And you were a busy guy. You had six kids. That alone is a full-time job. And
that it is.
Yeah. You told me age 25 to 16. And I'm personally, as a car restorer historian enthusiast myself, I'm intrigued, and I would highly recommend people to take a look at your YouTube show called Cars, Coffee, and Theology. I got to hear about that just for a second before we get into that. How did that come about?
Yeah. Well, you know, there's obviously Seinfeld was the inspiration for a lot of spinoffs of the kind of idea of, you know, driving around talking with the car. But I, part of my job and part of the joy of my life is that I've been privileged to know a lot of great scholars and authors. And
yeah,
and I love to talk with friends and just talk about their books and talk about their ideas. And I also love my old sports car, a Mazda RX-8. You know, it's a Series 1 stick shift, six speed. And it's tons of fun to drive. And I thought, well, if Seinfeld could do this, I could do it, right? And I think what I'm proud about the show is that the conversations are actually really substantive.
Yeah.
You know, like on Seinfeld or something, you love to watch it because they're all celebrities. But
right.
The conversation is, it's just kind of they're celebrities. But what I really try to do on that show is talk with interesting people about their books in depth. And
yeah.
It's tons of fun. So really like it.
So all right, I know we have other topics, but what's been your kind of your favorite Cars, Coffee, and Theology interview? Who was that with and what was it about?
Oh my goodness. We have 23 episodes out right now.
Anything stand out to you as a...
So many. I mean, the most popular one is with my colleague, Tom Schreiner, who, you know,
okay.
He's famous and great. You know, I think one of the guys that makes me laugh the most is an old friend from my PhD days in St. Andrews. His name is Steve Guthrie, and he teaches at Bellarmine in Nashville.
Okay.
And he's both a professional musician and a theologian. He has a PhD in theology.
Yeah.
And a great musician. And so we talked about creativity and spirituality, and he just makes me laugh. So that was one of my favorite episodes.
I've watched a couple of them. They're really fun. And I don't know how you shift gears, drink coffee, read theology. I guess you just make circles on a big parking lot so you don't get distracted.
We drive over everywhere. And in fact, my producer always would say, you have got to watch the road.
Oh, my goodness. Very fun. Well, hey, we're here to talk about your book, Jesus, the Great Philosopher, Rediscovering the Wisdom Needed for the Good Life. And this is a outstanding topic, and I'm really glad to hear more about it. I think, you know, especially for those in our audience that are involved in classical Christian schools, I mean, we choose these schools because we know that there is a theological core that the person of Jesus is glorified and honored. And yet sometimes we maybe just overlook the basics of, well, kind of who is Jesus and what is our real image of Jesus? So talk a little bit about what was the impetus behind the book and what's this problem that you're trying to address of the biblical image of Jesus that we've seemingly have lost.
Yeah. And it's been a joyful journey for me. So I'm a Matthew scholar, whatever that is, a person who's spent a lot of the last 20 years studying Matthew. And then that kind of led me to spend a lot of time in the Sermon on the Mount. I've done a lot of teaching and preaching from the Sermon on the Mount. And as I was working on the Sermon on the Mount more intently, I pretty quickly realized that I needed some help to understand it. And where I finally found that help was in an older Christian tradition, kind of a pre-Reformation tradition. And then particularly, I found a ton of help in the starting to read more and more in Greek and Roman philosophy, in particular, just understanding the virtue tradition, which is really at the core of the classical education model, shaping people through education, not just teaching skills or something like that. And so the whole idea of virtue, and as you probably well know, you know, virtue comes from virtus, which means human, right? And to be virtuous is to be human. It's to enter into the excellence of what it means to be human. And so all of that really ended up informing how I read the Sermon on the Mount. And I wrote a book called The Sermon on the Mount and Human Flourishing. And as I kept working on that, and I just kept seeing that the whole Bible was really about human flourishing. It wasn't just the Sermon on the Mount. And so that's what this book is about, is just kind of rediscovering and helping people see that the Old and the New Testaments really present themselves as documents that are about, and truth that is about, what it means to enter into the fullness of humanity that is revealed to us by God, the true God of the universe, and ultimately revealed to us through Jesus Christ.
So you talk about that. I mean, you use the word philosophy a lot, which is kind of a scary word for probably a lot of people. And, and you directly link that Jesus was a philosopher. I mean, so what do you see that maybe Jesus was onto that maybe a lot of us moderns have missed related to that?
Well, and that almost wasn't the title, because I had to fight that battle with the publisher for about a year to put philosopher in the title, because everybody was like, Jesus is a philosopher. Not only does that sound weird, but you can't sell a book with the philosopher in the title. But I won that battle because, and I hope, you know, people will pick up the book and read it, because I'm trying to redeem a word. I'm trying to redeem a great word. A philosopher in the ancient world was a wise person, a sage, a teacher of not only skills, again, but of a way inhabiting the world that promises true life. And what one of the things that really struck me is that when you start to read the church fathers in the first few centuries of the church, you realize that one of the main ways they talked about Jesus was actually as a philosopher. And a lot of the sacred art in mosaics and frescoes and paintings of all sorts regularly depicted Jesus looking exactly like a philosopher. That's why we think of him wearing robes, et cetera. That's the philosopher's garb. And so I had to think, what in the world, you know, is going on here? Why did they talk that way? Well, the key is you have to understand that philosophy, again, doesn't mean this esoteric, you know, ivory tower, far removed from practicality, like it often unfortunately means today. You know, when you leave the room, does this chair exist? You know, and that's the extent of the kind of discussion. But philosophy really meant the most practical wisdom for how to be a parent, for how to be an educator, for how to be a worker, for how to be a husband, how to be a wife, how to be a worker, you know, have employees and be an employer. And that's really how the earliest Christians and the Bible itself presents Jesus, as offering wisdom for entering into fullness of life. So that's how it kind of came about. It's kind of a rediscovery. This is not original to me. It's really a rediscovery of an ancient idea.
Well, and you talk in the book about just this idea of who are the gurus, or who do we really want to emulate today? And I think that, you know, I wonder, again, through the lens of, or through the experience of those of us in classical Christian schools, is that we love philosophy, and we love our kids sitting around big Socratic tables talking about, you know, what did Socrates say about this, or Plato about that. But then Jesus is almost, it feels like maybe Jesus gets kind of relegated over the corner. Like when we need the guy in the sandals to, you know, to show up and give us a few, you know, how to love our neighbor talks, then we'll bring Jesus in. But Jesus is almost left out of those heavier conversations, which I wonder if that's not part of the root issue of our cultural problem today, is that the big questions in life don't get answered because the guy in the sandals doesn't get a seat at the table.
that's a great way of analyzing it. I think that's what's happened too. And I think that's a big part of my desire for this book is to rediscover that the Christian faith and Jesus himself deserves a place at the table, I think we'd say the head of the table even.
Yeah.
And maybe to change the metaphor, the way I talk about it in the book is that a Christian knows that the Bible has a lot to say about the vertical aspect of our lives, our relationship with God. But it's not always really clear how Christianity and the Bible relates to the horizontal aspects of our lives, relationships with others, work, emotions, happiness, money, you know, all these things that maybe you'll hear some sermons on occasionally, but we'd say those are kind of secondary or peripheral to what the faith is about. But what I'm trying to show is that the Bible is super practical on offering wisdom for life. And
yeah.
And so that we need the vertical and we also need the horizontal. And in fact, they're, you know, organically connected to each other. So and the way I talk about it in the book is that the answers you get from anything like the Bible are based on the questions you ask. And we've stopped asking the Bible the most important questions, like what's the nature of the universe? What does it mean to be human? How do I be truly happy? How do I think about emotions?
Yeah.
What are relationships about? And when we stop asking those questions from the Bible, then we go to Jordan Peterson or Oprah Winfrey or
right.
Warren Buffett, or we go to all these other people to help us figure those out and they're still good in a lot of those people, right? But that we need to make sure we're asking the Bible.
I think this is, it's a fantastic way that you frame this because I it's just such a part of the air we breathe every day is by default, we're all hungry for wisdom, and we tend to think we know kind of the Bible, especially those of us who've grown up in the church. I know about Jonah and the whale. I know about feeding the 5,000. I know the stories, and I love Jesus, and I worship, and I sing songs and all of that. But I don't know that, again, back to being at the table or just having a voice and the very thing I'm trying to pursue. I mean, at the end of the day, the end goal is this idea of human flourishing. I know that term gets overused. You differentiate in the book the difference in happiness versus meaningful happiness. Can you talk a little bit about that? Because that's really that's what we all want. And there is a okay way. I mean, again, happiness, I think, gets dismissed as the light and fluffy, superficial, secular stuff. But there's a biblical notion of profound, meaningful happiness. Talk about that.
Yeah, and the words here are the trick, right? Because words are always changing their meaning and words are getting weaker over time. And as C.S. Lewis said, you know, once you start having to put an adjective in front of a noun, you know the noun is dying or it's getting weak, right? So to say meaningful happiness, that shows you that the word happy is getting weaker, you know? And that's certainly the case. You know, even 100 years ago, 150 years ago, 200 years ago, the English word happy was much more robust. Now I think we probably use it to mean temporary state of positive emotion
right.
or something. And that's not sufficient to understand the idea we're talking about here. And that's why usually the Greek word behind it, eudaimonia or makarios, a little later, those words mean something probably more like what we mean by flourishing or thriving, or to use biblical language, shalom. Mm-hmm. I think peace, but more than peace, you know, flourishing, aliveness, thriving. And so that's a big part of the point is that that's something the Bible cares about. That's not opposite of the biblical message. That's not something we'd say, well, God just wants us to have duty, and then we'll find about happiness, kind of feeling guilty about it from other places. But instead, that's the grand vision of the Bible, is the restoration of humanity to, as Jesus says in John 10:10, I've come that you might have life and have it abundantly. That's the good life. That's the true flourishing life. But maybe I didn't answer your question. What was it? Maybe I missed part of it.
No, I think I'm just thinking in terms of what is it that when we think of I think that it's exactly, I'm not being articulate about this. The words that we use are preloaded in every way. I mean, again, to your point, we have to put an adjective in front of the noun because happiness, and I think a lot of us, again, in speaking again to classical Christian people, I think we're quick to be dismissive of things that sound too touchy-feely emotional because that's the fluffy stuff that the world trades in, and we're about the harder, deeper thinking. But we've also, but you know, you can't live joyfully on grit and rigor. You have to somehow find, if you're going to flourish, it has to, because you've encountered joy and abundance, and those are not things we should be afraid of. And so I love the way that Jesus, again, is all about the substance and the depth and the philosophy. So we're going to take a break in a second. When we come back, I want to get into this idea of how do we live intentionally? I mean, how, if we invite this, you know, Jesus biblically, who is a philosopher, or, you know, into our lives in a much more deep way. What does that mean for us, how we live differently and how we engage, which I know is a big part of what you talk about in the book. So why don't we take a quick break? We'll come back and explore how we live this out, which is a really important question, because we're all in one way or another really trying to seek what is the meaning in life and how do we live that out faithfully in our homes and in our schools. We'll be right back with Jonathan Pennington. He's worked with families for more than 30 years as a licensed professional counselor and marriage family therapist. It's time for a quick encouragement on the best practices of raising the next generation. We call it a McCurdy moment. Keith, you talk a lot about kids having rigor and grit and this idea of struggle. It seems so counterintuitive to everything that as a parent we want to do to kind of protect our kids, even though we want them to kind of go out into the real world someday. So help me understand the struggle. That just does not seem like something we would want.
Well, I tell you, I'll frame it this way. I'll use an example. My son's an Eagle Scout, and he had to do an Eagle Scout project. And of course, he's helped many of his other buddies on their Eagle Scout projects. And in the course of that project, they had to move 10 tons of earth by hand with pickaxes and shovels. And I thought it was ridiculous. I mean, it was unbelievable what they had to do. And that was a struggle. It was a hard thing over multiple weekends. And it's interesting because I would tell you three things we learned from struggle I could easily see in that process for my son. You know, the first is my son, I would say, learned that most things in life that we think are going to be a big deal, by going through the struggle of it, we realize it really wasn't that big a deal. It was just hard. It was hard, but it really wasn't as earth-shattering or as impossible as it may have seemed on the front end. So struggle helps us reframe really what is a big deal. The second thing is my son learned he was a lot more capable than he thought he was. You know, when you're faced with a struggle and you have to work your way through it, you realize God made us capable. He actually did make us to operate in this broken world. And then the third is that struggle gives us a different perception about our community. We start to learn the value of others. One of the interesting things in the world of scouting is when you do an Eagle project, you can't do the project yourself. You have to enlist the help of others. And my son learned the value of having multiple other folks work with him to accomplish something that was very difficult. And there are very few things in life, I think, that can shape those three arenas in such a way. You know, struggle gives us the raw material to have perspective that we really are meant to operate in this, and we can do it, and we can do it in a community.
It does make me wonder from a parent perspective. We struggle by definition means it's going to be messy, and I think we never want to come off as messy parents or inadequate parents, and I wonder how often we intercept the problem because it might create friction and difficulty, and that might somehow look bad on us.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, we often wrap our own sense of worth up in the notion of, are our children successful and happy? And if we can put ourselves in the mix, we can better guarantee a certain outcome.
Yeah.
Rather than letting them struggle to develop so later in life they're capable.
Yeah, I guess nobody's ever sent a Christmas card with their kids struggling on it. I mean, that would never be really a great Christmas card. We find other shit. So, but I think it speaks to that sense of, which is nothing wrong with sending a nice Christmas card. Thanks, Keith. Got a question for Keith to answer on a future McCurdy moment? Well, send it to us at info@basecamplive.com and learn more about Keith McCurdy on the speaking page on the Basecamp Live website. Welcome to Basecamp Live. Back here talking to Dr. Jonathan Pennington about how to live the abundant life and really understanding where Jesus fits into this idea that even though we all kind of, many of us grew up in the church and it's kind of familiarity breeds complacency, there is a truth there that we often dismiss. You have a great quote in your book, "We long for flourishing." I would say most people agree with that. And the only way to find it is through living intentionally and thoughtfully in particular ways. Neither virtue nor its evidential fruit, happiness, comes to us accidentally. And so my question is, what are examples of living intentionally? And I know you talk about this in the book.
Yeah, thanks. So one of the ways that I was helped in understanding to read the Bible with these different set of questions, you know, this different set of questions, was from the ancient philosophers like Aristotle and Plato and Seneca and others. And one of the things about those kind of people who really thought a lot about what it means to be human and how to live well, how to build a good society, how to educate our children, they thought a lot about emotions, which, you know, sounds like philosophers and emotions. That was a major topic in ancient philosophy. They thought a ton about relationships and particularly friendship. And they thought a ton about what is the nature of happiness. And so what I did and what I do in the second half of the book is that I go to the Bible and say, okay, if those were big ancient philosophical concepts, does the Bible have anything to say about those very practical issues like friendship and emotions and happiness? And it turns out the Bible has a ton to say about those things. And so let's just take emotions for a second. You know, there's all kinds of ways that, well, we don't know what to do with emotions. Are they just chemicals? Are they something you could just tell yourself, stop it, don't do it? Are they something that we should deny and say emotions are bad? Or on the other end, some people would say, whatever you feel is what you should do. Otherwise, you're not being true to yourself. What's the Bible say about that? And what I discovered is that the Bible is so sophisticated, so nuanced, so thoughtful, as it should be, it's God's word, about affirming the goodness of emotions, not denying them. In fact, many emotions are necessary for godliness, like compassion, like love, like not being contentious, contentment, right? And there are lots of bad emotions like violent anger and hatred, and we could go on and on, lust, right? These are all emotions. And so the Bible's very pro-emotion, but God wants to shape us more and more into the image of Jesus Christ, and that includes shaping our emotional lives. So the practical part of that is learning to pay attention to your emotions, not denying them, nor thinking or feeling or acting like they are the only thing that if you feel it, you must do it. That there's a process throughout that the Bible teaches us and the Spirit works in us to learn to educate our emotions over time, to shape and form our emotions to be people of love and compassion, et cetera, more. So that's really one really practical thing I try.
So how does that, I mean, as a father of six, how does that play out? Because especially their kids, they can be quite emotional as they're learning to navigate life. How does that look? What does it look like in your home?
Such a great question. And we have, my wife's a professional artist. I've been a musician in the past. So we have a lot of emotions in our house.
They're
very, everybody's super creative and visual or musical artists. So there's a lot going on.
Yeah.
Emotionally. Well, you know, I would say in our first, 8 or 10 years of parenting, we didn't do a very good job of this. I think we're part of a, you know, we're young parents and we were very idealistically driven. We were homeschooling with some classical influence on us. And I think I mostly thought about children, about what they should be and how they should act and how they should feel. And that wasn't all bad, but what really pivoted for us 10 or 12 years ago through just some suffering in our lives and some awareness, health issues, et cetera, was we moved from parenting about what they should be to what they could be, and to really focus on helping each child develop as a human in the way God has made them. And a big part is their emotions. And so just sort of recognizing that emotions are okay, they're normal, creating space for it's okay. You don't have to crack down on them and yell at them, you know, yell at them to not yell at people or whatever it is. But we can create space and teach them to process their emotions and to think about them. Because if we don't teach them to do that, they may learn it or they may never. And there's plenty of adults who are just reacting their whole life rather than educating their emotions. So for us, it was a real pivot about the midpoint of our parenting to start paying attention to our children a little bit more, not just thinking about forming them to be in my image, but forming them to be in God's image, which looks a little different for each kid. And a big part of that was letting them have their emotions and seeking to educate them for them.
And so super practical. I mean, letting them have their emotions means if they're having an emotional meltdown, I mean, engaging them in that moment, that that's not something to be dismissed, that that's a part of what it means to be human is to have an emotional meltdown moment.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, don't you and Eisenbein?
Yes.
Yeah. You know, your wife called me beforehand. And
oh, great. She always does that.
And of course, you know, a lot of this is age driven too. You know, when a 18-month-old is throwing a fit, you know, I'm not reasoning with them about that. And especially if it's disobedience, you know, there's going to be some kind of discipline involved. But I do think recognizing that humans are developing over time and in an age appropriate way, you know, addressing their emotions
yeah.
and saying, and maybe even saying, you know, to a younger one, and I'm kind of looking forward to grandparenting. I get round two of this and do a better job of it, you know, but, you know, just creating space to look a kid in the eyes and say, hey, you seem to be really upset right now. You seem to be really angry right now. You seem to be really sad right now, whatever it is. It's okay. Right. Is this something you want to talk about right now? Or maybe we can calm down right now and then talk about that later. That's okay too. And, you know, all that requires being a centered person yourself. You know, that's the key where when I was a younger parent, I think it's probably true for a lot. I was so intense on making sure they were trained well and disciplined well, you know, and not embarrassing that I wasn't centered myself to have the space for them to be okay. Right. And that was the biggest thing for me.
Yeah. And as you're saying that, I'm thinking too, I can, being in kind of relating this back to school world, I can also think a lot of times, especially of younger teachers who've never had children that are very geared around philosophical thinking and humanities, and they're trying to run a class in a very linear, rational way. And they don't understand that the seventh grade, eighth grade group in front of them are trading in the in emotional currency. And how do you, you know, if you don't relate to that, or if you quickly dismiss that or see it as a discipline problem, you've lost a whole dynamic of how they even engage life. And so that's, so under this kind of initial question of how do you live intentionally? And you identified emotions being, we've got to kind of work in that emotional space to maximize our beinghood, really, I guess, in terms of living and flourishing. So what else would we want to focus on?
Yeah. And so relationships would be the second one.
Yeah.
And, you know, everything about our life is a relationship, you know, peers, people above us, people below us as you get older in terms of age and hierarchy of authority, et cetera. And so we really need to be intentional about thinking about how we relate to other people. And once again, when you go to the Bible and the Christian faith, you recognize, wow, it has a ton to say about relationships. And particularly, I think of the Gospels and maybe even particularly the Gospel of Matthew. One of the main theological themes of Matthew is that Christians are those who relate to each other in relationships of mercy. And mercy is a two-sided coin. It means forgiving those who have wronged you. So you can think of like Matthew 18 and other places, or the Lord's Prayer, if you do not forgive others their sins, your Heavenly Father will not forgive you. And mercy, the other side of the mercy coin, is showing compassion to those in need. So those are kind of two aspects of mercy. And those really mark the Christian, according to the Christian disciple, according to Jesus in Matthew. And so that's one way to think about how the Bible challenges us, invites us to learn to be very thoughtful about how we relate to other people, that it's not irrelevant. It's actually part of being a Christian as you relate to other people with mercy and love. But especially one of the most exciting things for me about that book, and I'm doing some more writing on this in another book, is the idea of friendship. And I have a pretty lengthy discussion in there. I don't know if it's pretty lengthy, but I think a hearty discussion in the two chapters in the book about relationships that have to do with friendship, because in the ancient world, that was considered the highest kind of relationship. Where for us, we tend to think of a romantic relationship as the highest kind of relationship. And I push back on that a little bit. I'm all for marriage and romance. That's great. But there is friendship is a different kind of relationship than a romantic relationship. And to channel C.S. Lewis again in his, you know, famous Four Loves book, one of the ways he talks about it is that lovers are looking eye to eye or face to face. Friends are shoulder to shoulder looking out on the world. Those are two different kinds of relationships, and they both have their place. But there's a way in which friendship is in some ways more meaningful, at least in the ancient world, that's how they understood it. And so the intentional application of that is you and I have to really be intentional about developing friendships, especially male-male friendships and female-female friendships. You can also do it cross-gender, but it's hard for the romantic element not to come in, right? And so you have to be more careful, especially if you're already married, right? But the importance of not centering your life only around your romantic relationship and your children, even that men need men in their lives to be friends with, and women need women in their lives to be friends with. And that's something I am convinced that you can tell a lot about the health of a person psychologically and even physically by looking at the quality of their friendships, even more than their marriage.
absolutely agree with that. And so in this idea of how do we guide ourselves and others to live intentionally and the importance of understanding biblically our emotions and our relationships and our friendships. So tie it back to, I mean, the idea of the book really is Jesus being a philosopher. And we talked earlier in the podcast just about don't be afraid of that term, and that it's how does that, the intersection of, or maybe the way that plays out with, again, if you're talking to someone, I would, again, I think most people would say, yes, Jonathan, you're right. Friendships, managing our emotions, relationships. How does that, what are examples of how you in the book tie it back into the way Jesus directly speaks to those needs to live intentionally?
Yeah, it's great. Well, I mean, the first is the biggest way is just to say that, again, when you look at the Bible, Old and New Testament, it cares about these ideas. It traffics in these ideas. It talks a ton about friendship, actually. It talks about relationships like mercy. And we can even see great examples, David and Jonathan, Ruth and Naomi. But then the ultimate example is that Jesus calls these 12 men to be with him. And especially at this turning, this key moment in the upper room discourse, he turns to them in John and says, I call you friends. And that has, I mean, in the ancient world, that would have meant a lot more than it means to us, you know, because we might call, hey, you know, I met this guy, we're friends. But in the ancient world, to call someone a friend means that you are intimately locked arms with them and you're living life together and you're committed to each other in a kind of covenantal relationship. And so it's really remarkable how much the Bible and Jesus himself uses this category of friendship to describe what, how we should be relating to each other. Is that what you're answering?
Yeah, no, I think, just trying to understand, because I think in a vacuum, yes, emotions need to be rightly, both appreciated and then rightly balanced. And I think friendship needs to be acknowledged for the abundant life. And you've got to have, you know, based on biblical understanding of the importance of relationships, especially in a moment now, culturally, where loneliness is one of the greatest issues that people face, lonely in a crowd. I mean, only in America, it seems like. What else? I know, again, time's getting short here a little bit, but just other discoveries you've made about how we live intentionally, given this understanding of Jesus as a philosopher who's guiding this path that we're to be on.
Yeah, well, we talked about a little bit in the first half, so I can just be more brief here, but just the question of happiness, really, that again, we all long to be happy. I mean, I could quote Augustine and a million other people, you know, Seneca, everybody, Christian and non-Christian, who's ever been thoughtful about life, acknowledges we all care about being happy. And actually, it drives most of what we do, if not everything we do.
Yeah.
And so again, we go to the Bible and say, does the Bible care about happiness? Because that sounds kind of, makes me feel guilty. Can't care about our help. But what about take up your cross, right? Et cetera. And so when you go to the Bible and you see that, again, it has a ton of words for the happy or flourishing life, shalom, et cetera, and that they are not insignificant parts of the Bible's message. It is a huge part of the Bible's message from creation to new creation, is that God wants to restore the fullness of life to us. We don't have to feel guilty about that. We don't have to feel bad. The kind of the shocking part of it is that Jesus is very clear in this. It's probably one of the greatest human paradoxes, that happiness is deeply embedded in this life with suffering.
Yeah.
And that's the unexpected part. And that's where the taking up the cross comes in, because Jesus is modeling for us in his own life and teaching explicitly to us that the way of true happiness is the way of the way of the cross. That doesn't mean gloom and doom and sadness. In fact, why did Jesus himself take up the cross according to Hebrews? For the joy set before him, both in the midst of it and then ultimately. And so the point is, the Bible cares a ton about happiness. It speaks about it. It's the beginning of the story. It's the very end of the story, is shalom, glory, peace, joy. But the answer that the Bible gives about what happiness is to learn to embrace both joy. We're Christians, can be joyful people, joy, but in the midst of suffering, persecution, misrepresentation, malignment, those are not the opposite of happiness. Those are paradoxically a primary means to true happiness.
Yeah. No, that's, and again, I think these are probably familiar ideas at one level. At the other, they're often kind of left untried. I think about, as you're talking about, I think about Chesterton's quote, the Christian ideal has not been tried and found wanting. It has been found difficult and left untried. And, and I think a lot of it's like, I know I'm supposed to have friends. I know I'm supposed to, you know, be intentional in the way that I relate and I'm in control of my emotions. And, but at the same time, it's just hard. It's hard in our world today, and you have to make intentional decisions. And I think especially as we're in the role of guiding either our own children or children in our classes, I think, you know, it's not always easy. So.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Well, Jonathan, thank you so much for your encouraging us in this, that, I mean, every one of us listening wants to live the abundant life. And sometimes even though we know the answers, we don't always do them very well. So thanks for kind of encouraging us down that path. If folks want to learn more about you, and we talked about your great, Cars, Coffee and Theology, that's a lot of fun. If they want to watch that, that's on YouTube, I guess. Just put it up, put in that particular title. It comes up. What about the book and your other resources?
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, Cars, Coffee, Theology on YouTube is great. Everything is also connected to JonathanPennington.com, if you can spell that long name. Thanks, Mom. But JonathanPennington.com has tons of videos of me teaching, tons of sermons, lectures, links to my books, other things.
Yeah.
There's also, we run a podcast called Human Flourishing Podcast. Mm-hmm. It's on Apple and wherever you get your podcast, that is basically a always updating, populating list of sermons, teachings, things like that, that I'm doing various places.
So. Sounds great. And I know this summer you're speaking at the Society of Classical Learning's conference on education and human flourishing. And so if you're listening to this podcast before that, join us at the conference. If it's afterwards, the recordings are out there, and look forward to hearing you talk on that topic as well. But Jonathan, thanks so much. It's been a delight talking with you.
Absolutely the same. Thank you so much.
Hey there, everyone. This is Paul Drake with Basecamp Live and the Society for Classical Learning. Davies and I are excited you tuned in today. We want to hear where you are listening from. So send in a shout out or a question to info@basecamplive.com. And don't forget, share this podcast with someone you think will benefit from it. And until next time, keep on raising the next generation.